Hello and welcome to the July episode of Solidarity Is This. My name is Deepa Iyer, and I'm so pleased that you're joining me for another episode of our monthly podcast, where we explore solidarity practices in light of the current political environment and America's rapidly changing demographics. For more background on why I started the Solidarity Is This podcast and the issues that we'll be talking about, please check out the first episode entitled Bystander Upstander, available on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Or you can listen right off of www.solidarityis.org. I hope you'll subscribe, provide your feedback and input, and share the podcast with your networks. This month's podcast is called The Muslim and Refugee Bans. And joining me are Ramla Saheed, Executive Director of the Partnership for the Advancement of New Americans in San Diego, and Alika Wafai, Staff Attorney for National Security and Civil Rights at Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco. Alika and Ramla, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Deepa.
Thanks for having us.
So why are we talking about the Muslim and refugee bans this week? Because they represent and are part and parcel of a policy of criminalization and othering. And in just a few months, the U.S. Supreme Court will be taking up this policy to assess its constitutionality. So just a little bit about how we got to this point. Days after the presidential inauguration, the Trump administration issued an executive order that banned travel from seven Muslim-majority countries and suspended the refugee resettlement process. The public outcry was immediate. You may remember the images from airports all around the country, JFK, Dulles, O'Hare, San Francisco, where people were holding up signs such as "Refugees Welcome" and "No Muslim Ban." Civil rights and refugee rights organizations like Ramla's and Alika's called the ban unconstitutional, discriminatory, and inhumane. In New York City, Yemeni business owners shut down their bodegas in protest of the ban for a day. The heads of tech companies and universities denounced the ban, sharing stories about its harmful effects on their employees, international students, and faculty members. Not surprisingly, individuals and organizations sued the federal government over the executive order, saying that it violated the Constitution because it targeted a particular religion, given that the countries banned are majority Muslim populations. And many federal judges agreed. They found that the Trump administration's justification that these bans served a national security purpose didn't pass legal muster. In fact, a federal judge in Maryland found, and I quote, "A reasonable, objective observer, enlightened by the specific historical context, contemporaneous public statements, and specific sequence of events leading to its issuance, would conclude that the executive order was issued with a purpose to disfavor a particular religion." So many courts around the country blocked the Muslim and refugee bans. That is, until June, when the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in. The Supreme Court has allowed implementation of the ban in a limited fashion. While things could shift again quickly, right now the federal government is able to ban travel for 3 months from six Muslim-majority countries, including Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, and suspend refugee resettlement for 4 months. If travelers and refugees can show that they have a bona fide relationship with a person or an entity in the United States, they're not subject to the ban. But the government's interpretation of what constitutes a bona fide relationship has been met with wide criticism. For example, can even grandparents be banned? As the journey to the Supreme Court begins, the High Court plans to hear the Muslim and refugee ban cases in October. How do we prepare? How do we practice solidarity? Ramla from the Partnership for the Advancement of New Americans in San Diego and Alika from the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco are here to help us answer these questions and more. So Ramla and Alika, I first wanted to get a sense of what drew both of you into the work that you're doing, particularly around the Muslim and refugee bans. Ramla?
I want to start by saying that my entry into this work, it was roundabout and accidental. I was a nutrition counselor for several years. Over time, I learned that it was impossible for low-income women with children struggling to make ends meet. So I left that work, kind of disheartened, and became an unemployed activist. And truly found myself happy again when I became a community organizer. And after several years of doing it, I decided that I wanted to win for families that have backgrounds like mine. So refugees are people who are incredibly resilient, people who share the experience of displacement and having to start over again to rebuild a sense of home. Muslims, African immigrants, and also I wanted to build with other women.
And what about you, Alika? Why are these issues, in particular the Muslim and refugee ban, so important to you personally?
As an Iranian American, my entry point into this work was in the wake of 9/11 and seeing my community and those from other Muslim majority countries who had to go register with immigration officials through the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, NSEERS. And seeing the targeting and the discrimination and exploitation of immigration status through a national security program was deeply impactful, particularly given the history of the Iranian community and other communities from the Middle East and South Asia and what our communities went through in order to come to the United States. So really looking at, for the last 12 years, how do we connect immigrant rights to civil rights and national security work? And for Asian Law Caucus, the organization that I'm fortunate to work at, I think the entry is really looking at the fact that, you know, the organization was founded by Japanese American attorneys who worked to overturn Fred Korematsu's criminal conviction for resisting concentration camps during World War II. And the National Security and Civil Rights Program that we work in was founded in the wake of 9/11 and really looking at using litigation, policy, organizing, know your rights, all of the tools, and not just court, to secure the rights and liberties for Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, South Asian communities. And personally, as an Iranian American, I think I have been very struck by, you know, being at SFO that first weekend and seeing how many Iranians and my community members were there. But of course, seeing, you know, my community folks reach out has been particularly impactful on a personal level.
I think that for a lot of the people listening who are doing this work, both of your stories really resonate. A lot of this is so personal to us and for us. And we say often, no ban, no wall, no raids. And it's really, I think, aligned with what you were talking about, how these issues around the criminalization of immigrants, of Black communities, of immigrant communities, undocumented folks are all connected in some way. Tell us a little bit about the so-called registries and information collection that have affected communities in the past, because I want folks who are listening to know that the Muslim ban is not necessarily a new phenomenon.
We see the Muslim ban and the refugee ban and the Muslim registry as two sides of the same coin that are distinct but very interrelated. Of course, I think for our communities, one of the main registration programs that comes to mind is NSEERS, which ran, you know, from 2002 to 2011 and required certain non-immigrant men from Muslim-majority countries to go and register with the federal government. So many individuals were fingerprinted and questioned and targeted solely because of their national origin, which was really used as a proxy to get at a religious group, to get at Muslim communities. And we know now that over 83,000 individuals complied with NSEERS and that at least 13,000 were placed in the pipeline for deportation. All of those individuals were questioned and information collected about them specifically. We also, of course, have the historical documentation about the role that the U.S. Census Bureau and census data and FBI surveillance data was used during World War II when Japanese Americans were forced into concentration camps. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's so many mechanisms to achieve the goal of a Muslim ban, whether that's through the executive order or through backdoor policies, right? We saw changes in the visa laws that said certain immigrants from certain communities and countries now have to provide social media handles, 15 years of travel history and how that was financed. And so collecting that information and making it essentially a hurdle to be able to enter in the first place outside of the four corners of the executive order are all aspects that we're looking at to see how is this information collected, what are the different programs and mechanisms, and how do we really approach this given that lens.
And that knowledge of the history that you talked about, Alika, is, I think, very important because I know that it's in part what propelled the solidarity campaign that you all and other organizations engaged in San Francisco to pass the first anti-registry ordinance in the country. Can you tell us a little bit about this ordinance, what it does, what it prohibits, and really kind of give people out there an example of what they might be able to do in their own communities using this particular ordinance as a model?
So a number of California organizations joined together in the wake of the election result to pass actually a California statewide policy, SB 31, which says that California resources, data, facilities can't be used to support a discriminatory federal registry program and protects the way that certain information is collected, again, drawing lessons from NSEERS, drawing lessons from Japanese incarceration. And what we saw as SB 31 has been moving its way through the legislative process is local geographies wanting to step up in the face of the Trump administration, in the face of a Trump FBI or Immigration Customs Enforcement controlled by Trump, to say, what can we do as local geographies? How can we step up, protect our communities, and really show a sense of resistance? And so when San Francisco was looking at options to protect Arab Middle Eastern Muslim communities from the campaign promise of registering Muslims, we worked with a coalition, of course, CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, AROC, ASATA, NLG, the ACLU, to make sure that the local policy that was being written actually protected the community and had real teeth and used language that was going to be strong enough to achieve those goals. The San Francisco anti-registry policy, similar to SB 31, prohibits creating discriminatory lists based on national origin, ethnicity, or religion. It protects local data and local staff from participating in that. And we added a layer of public reporting for compliance, and also, if the ordinance is violated, then the city can be held liable for damages up to $5,000. And we did hear very clearly that what pushed the city to do that was the community leaders, our local leaders that stepped up and came out in the dozens for public comment. So really a community-driven, community-led effort to ensure the highest protection.
And so to be clear, the anti-registry ordinance that you're talking about can't, for example, prevent the federal government from implementing the Muslim and refugee bans, as we've been talking about, but it is a form of resistance, as you said, and it is a form of accountability for local government to say that we will not initiate, we will not contribute to gathering information about people based on national origin or religion. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the end of the day, you know, we still have federal preemption, but the reality is, as we've seen in so many other movements and so many other areas, particularly in the immigrant rights space, a lot of these goals and campaign promises can't be achieved without local support or local participation and local resources.
So I want to take a moment right now to point out some of the solidarity practices that we've talked about that maybe our listeners might want to engage in as we ramp up to the Supreme Court hearing in October. The first is that language matters. It's really important that we don't call what is happening right now just a travel ban, that we actually name it for what it is, that it is a Muslim and refugee ban. The second is that statements matter. So how can we condemn the bans and reassert values of inclusion and equality, whether it's through personal letters to the editor that we write or through visible signs outside our synagogues, churches, and temples that say that refugees and Muslims are welcome, or even through statements from organizations, faith leaders, university presidents, legislators. These are all ways in which the community at large can condemn the Muslim and refugee bans for what they are. We'll have a link to the anti-registry ordinance that Alika talked about, as well as some other resources in the Solidarity syllabus for this episode over at www.solidarityis.org. So now I want to turn it over to Ramla to get your perspective from the ground in San Diego. I know your organization works with refugees, including Somalis who are impacted by this particular ban, as well as others. So tell us a little bit about how the refugee and Muslim bans have been affecting refugees specifically in the communities that you work in, Ramla.
I can only describe what's been happening as simply re-traumatization. Many of the parents we work with have made this exact statement. This is the same hatred and vitriol that we thought we left behind. Many newcomers and former refugees have talked to us about leaving this country also to go to Canada or a more welcoming country. People seem to be losing hope for ever reuniting with family members, and they desperately want to find ways to make sure that the son that they left behind, the grandma that they left behind, that there's a foreseeable future where they can be together. In one case, we had a family who was expected to resettle and reunite with family here in San Diego. Their first travel was canceled as a result of Muslim Ban 1, and we were able to work together to have their flight rescheduled. And even though this family technically had a valid visa, they had their flights yet again canceled due to Muslim Ban 2.0. Today, the family is no longer eligible to travel due to expiring medical clearances. Because, you know, what we found out in the process of trying to get their travel rebooked is that the medical screening is only good for 180 days. And so we're wondering, you know, how many more families who were eligible to travel and have been impacted by Muslim bans are now ineligible to travel because of expiring clearances. And, you know, what is the process for that? And so figuring out and having conversations with folks about how do we mitigate against, you know, the effects of Muslim Ban 2 that and 1 that seem to also create yet another backdoor, another, you know, create another de facto Muslim ban in and of itself. And making sure that we're telling those stories so people understand that, you know, even if we win the court battles, damage has been done in real ways to families.
So Rumla, in the beginning, you talked about how it's really important to recognize that people who are fleeing their home countries and coming here as refugees are facing, in a sense, the same vitriol and the same persecution that they thought they were escaping. And I think that's a really important point. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit more, maybe in particular talking about the Somali refugee community.
Somalia has not had a functioning central government for over 25, 26 years. Mm-hmm. So there are still millions of people who are internally displaced by both violence and persecution, and also famine. And there are still millions of people who are in refugee camps like Dadaab in Kenya. And the vast majority of refugees don't actually leave the refugee camp. In the case of Dadaab, there are people who were born in refugee camps, grew up in refugee camps, got married and had children in refugee camps. There's only like 1% globally of refugees who ever make it to a third home like the United States. So when people come here, there's a lot of hope for rebuilding a sense of home and a sense of identity within this new home. And so when, you know, you have the president of the United States of America getting up there and spewing the same hatred that they sort of experience, it re-traumatizes people. Mm-hmm. And to give you a more explicit example, one mom, her name's Miriam Adams, she's one of our leaders. She is an incredible force of power. And she talks about, you know, how it all started, she says. And it starts with hateful rhetoric. It starts with hate speech. It turns into violence. And that, if it's not, you know, if it's not fought against, could very easily lead to a collapse of a country. Mm. And so for her, this was, I'm really worried about what's going to happen for the future and what's going to happen to my children.
And that's such an important, I think, lesson to hear, to not normalize any of what's happening, because it is a slippery slope, as you mentioned.
And it's why the vast majority of people who actually don't agree with this need to be speaking up in more public ways to kind of show support for those who are impacted, but to also show those who would cause harm to others that it's not okay and it's not happening here. That's why resistance is so important.
So speaking a little bit about that resistance, right? I know that you all are located, you know, just about a half hour or so from the U.S.-Mexico border. I feel that your mission really integrates what's also happening at the border, and you've called for no bans, no walls, no raids. So tell us a little bit about how being on the border is informing the work that you do with refugee communities as well as around the Muslim ban.
In 2008 and 2009 in San Diego, we saw the highest numbers of asylum seekers from Somalia and Ethiopia. These young men and women risked everything following the same routes as refugees from El Salvador and Honduras to the San Ysidro and Otaymeza border crossing. Mm. During the first few years, many of them would be offered humanitarian parole, meaning they would be detained initially, but then eventually let go into the community. And the community then would, you know, in the case of the Somali community, take in that person offering shelter, food, clothing, etc. And so the community really took that on as their responsibility. Over the years, that has changed, and it is now not uncommon to have people sort of linger in immigration detention for years. These are individuals who have fled persecution and violence and then are greeted right now by armed men and are thrown into jail cells. And what's worse is that today asylum seekers still do not have access to legal defense. They don't have access to health care. They don't have access to much language support and assistance, and are now actually being deported in masses. And when I say they're being deported in masses, I'm talking specifically about Somali asylum seekers who crossed the San Ysidro, Otaymeza, or border crossings in Texas. And the current targeting of asylum seekers and Somali asylum seekers and refugees by immigration officials for deportation is troubling. The 1951 UN Convention relating to refugees states that no one shall expel or return a refugee against his or her will in any manner whatsoever to a territory where he or she fears threats to life or freedom. Mm-hmm. Considering that Somalia is still experiencing decades of recurrent famines and humanitarian crisis, the morality of deporting asylum seekers and refugees should be questioned, and we should be asking more accountability from DHS on that.
That's the other part of this, the Muslim and refugee bans, that it's important to recognize that there's also been an uptick, as we know, in detentions and deportations in this country, and they are targeting at some level people who are Somali community members, as well as Kurds and Iraqis. So this is something that's also happening in the interior of this country as well. And I think you make that point so well, to understand the connection between the immigration detentions as system, as well as these kinds of policies around the Muslim and refugee bans. So Ramla, one last question about the work that you all are doing at PANA. I had the pleasure of visiting your space a few months ago, the community space that you all have in San Diego, and really talking to and meeting so many of the young people that are active in your organization. Tell us a little bit about how young folks that are really pushing back against resisting the Muslim and refugee bans, how are they engaging in that resistance? What is giving them that sense of hope and solidarity?
We have an active membership of hundreds of youth, but we also have a core membership of a few dozen youth, some of whom you met when you came down to San Diego to visit with us. Mm-hmm. And those young people are graduates of our youth academy. It was a 6-week intensive for community organizing and policy training. And we want youth to really understand kind of the tools that they have at their disposal to resist and resist well. They are also using the creative arts, poetry, spoken word, photography, painting to express themselves. We're also engaging them to support our, you know, translating skills they learned at the Advocacy Academy, and also, you know, their spoken word, their art, to translating that into actions at city council, you know, supporting our phone banking efforts to reach more community people, hosting community conversations just with youth about, you know, what they hope to do. What does it mean for them to resist as young people, and how do they lend support to their limited English parents who often are, you know, not so sure about how to engage in the public space? And we hope that through these activities and training and supports, we have basically an informed and engaged base of young leaders that lift up community voices and experiences on the issues, but also who become basically the faces of what it means to resist, right? Mm-hmm. And it's important because they come from the very communities, right, and very families who are impacted by this. So it's so important that they become sort of the bridge between their parents and grandparents who may not be able to you know, speak the language enough to come out publicly, but that they can relay those stories and they can tell the stories of their families well and do it in ways that contribute to continuous action and engagement with the public.
You all have reminded us that resistance is both in and outside of the courtroom. And as we do ramp up to October, I want to hear from both of you about what people can be doing between now and then to practice solidarity, to raise awareness about the impact of the Muslim and refugee bans. Alika, would you like to start?
I think we also can't forget that and erase or overlook the fact that undocumented immigrants and Black communities are facing significant assaults right now. And a point that we really emphasize in the ongoing Know Your Rights that we do in our Arab Middle Eastern Muslim communities is, one, not to overlook the fact that those communities are our communities, that there's intersections there. And two, we were so supported by the hundreds and thousands of people that came out across the airports. Are we showing up? Are we mobilizing when there's ICE issues, when there's assaults against Black communities as well? And so really making sure that as we're moving forward, we're taking this bigger picture into account, understanding our intersections and not just moving our issues forward is important.
Ramla, what do you think that we need to be doing to practice solidarity between now and the Supreme Court oral arguments on the Muslim and refugee bans in October?
You know, I couldn't agree more with Elika's statements about lifting up narratives. I think it's really important that we continue to lift the voice, visibility, and the impact of folks most impacted, right? Like, that means for us making sure that they're the ones that are telling their own stories, that we're putting human faces to this issue and centering, you know, how this actually impacts a community and a family, and humanizing people is going to be really important. We have a network of really amazing volunteers and community groups who basically sign up to like deliver water and like food and things like that when communities are holding like their own community conversations and things like that. And they know very well, you know, they can't stay for the community conversation, but the fact that they showed up, the fact that they offered support and they dropped off cases of water, whatever that need was in that particular action or event, I think says a lot, and it boosts the morale of the communities we're also working in because they see very clearly that they're not alone in this fight.
I think it's so important that you all mentioned various solidarity practices during our conversation. We talked about the importance of language. We talked about the importance of narrative shifting, about how ordinances and legislation that create sanctuary and safety can be a form of resistance. And we also talked about doing events in the public space. And I really want to encourage people who are listening to plan and participate in events like that between now and October to raise awareness around the Muslim and refugee bans and to do, as Ramla and Alika have told us, to really center the voices of people who are most affected, to think about what the role of history is, right? Whether it is the Japanese American internment that Alika spoke about, or whether it is what drives refugees to come to this country in the first place that Ramla spoke about. It could be a forum on your college campus, an interfaith conversation, or a community story share. Some key dates to think about for these events could be the 16-year anniversary of 9/11, National Welcoming Week for Immigrants and Refugees, which begins on September 15th, or the day of the Supreme Court hearing itself, which is October 10th. So as we close, I want to remind folks that you will find the resources that Alika and Ramla spoke about, as well as ideas for solidarity practices around the Muslim and refugee bans, over at www.solidarityis.org. Look for the Solidarity Syllabus and follow us at SolidarityIs on Twitter. And I also hope that you will check out the tremendous work that the organizations that Alika and Ramla represent are doing on the ground and nationally. It's panasd.org and advancingjustice-alc.org. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us and the work that you do, Alika and Ramla. We appreciate it so deeply.
Thanks so much, Deepa.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much.
As we close July's podcast, I'm thinking of Asata Shakur, a Black woman and a revolutionary in the struggle for Black liberation, who is now living in Cuba. Her birthday occurs in July, and it's an opportune time to remember her story. If you haven't read it yet, you may want to pick up her autobiography. Sister Asata said, Where there is oppression, there will always be resistance. And Sister Osata taught us right. We can see that resistance clearly in the ways in which people have been rising up and will continue to do so in response to the discriminatory and inhumane Muslim and refugee bans. Thank you for listening, and join me in August for another episode of Solidarity Is This.